We're very pleased this afternoon to have one of the guiding teachers of Boundless Way Zen, and sometimes we say he's the founder of Boundless Way Zen, if it's a thing that was founded, James Ford.
Normally in Sesshin, because I have evil co-teachers, I am not allowed to prep for a talk. So I have just luxuriated in pulling down my books and staring at them and meditating upon them in a totally non-Zen way. And here's what you must endure. Entangling Vines, Case 154. There was an old woman who supported a hermit. For 20 years, she always had a girl, 16 or 17 years old, take the hermit his food and wait on him. One day, she told the girl to give the monk a close hug and ask, "What do you feel just now?" The hermit responded, "An old tree on a cold cliff, midwinter, no warmth." The girl went back and told this to the old woman. The woman said, "For 20 years I've supported this vulgar good-for-nothing." So saying, she threw the monk out and burned down the hermitage. I first ran across this story, I'm pretty sure, in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. Maybe I was 17. I recall how I was both shocked and fascinated by it. Sex in a spiritual story didn't get any better for me. And not going to the way my Baptist upbringing inclined me to assume it would go. Where was the simple, clear moral? I was just enthralled and haunted, and you know, it continues to be so. I was a little surprised to not run across it in my formal Zen training. Yes, there were references here and there. Master Sung San treats it briefly in his anthology of koans with comments, The Whole World in a Single Flower. Robert Aitken Roshi cites it in his essay on sexuality in his classic Mind of Clover. And that was kind of it. For a while, I wasn't even sure it was properly a koan, as it isn't anthologized in the three big 12th century collections, The Gateless Gate, The Blue Cliff, or The Book of Serenity. Then Thomas Juho Kirchner released his wonderful translation of the Shuman Katsusho, Entangling Vines, first published in Japan at the end of the 17th century, and one of the major koan collections in Orthodox Japanese Rinzai. Entangling Vines is itself gleaned from various Chinese anthologies that were popular in that day. And it turns out the original of this koan is collected as case 6 of the Compendium of the Five Lamps, the Wuding Huiyan. Okay. Besides being novel and appealing to a 17-year-old, and maybe the 17-year-old in many of us, what do we do with it? No doubt it is tricky, in fact, maybe more difficult to get through to the heart of than with many other cases. There are just any number of ways we can distract ourselves from the heart of the matter under the best of circumstances. And here sex raises to the fore. In our contemporary culture, we can make much, should we wish, of the relationship between the old woman and the young woman she sends out to test the monk. In Master Sung San's version, she's a daughter. In Aitken Roshi's version, a niece. I do notice the Venerable Kirchner avoids any reference to the women's relationship. And good. There is, among other problems about how women are treated, a real issue in how the woman sends her daughter or niece or what off, whatever, off as a seductress. But I suggest they are for a different conversation, when we're ready to cut into the heart. Another significant but not on point for the koan part is how many people can see a straight ahead moral to the story. For instance, the Soto priest Nonan Choeni summarizes that most common and legitimate view nicely when he writes, "If Zen Buddhist practice has turned our hearts into stone and made us oblivious to human sensations and feelings, we have been doing it improperly." Here the case becomes a companion to the old story of the two monks walking and who meet a woman trying to cross a river and having trouble navigating the current. The one monk picks her up, carries her across, sets her down, and the two continue on. As you know, the story ends with the moralizing, "I put her down at the bank of the river, but you're still carrying her." Useful. Part of the richness we can find in the case. But not the direct pointing, not what makes it a koan rather than a parable. Still, before we move to the heart of the matter, or perhaps as we approach the heart of the matter, I find myself thinking of Gore Vidal's novel, Creation. It offers an important variation on the two monks and the woman and the river. Creation opens with an aged Persian ambassador to Athens, incensed as he hears Herodotus lecture on the Persian Wars, and decides to provide his own reminiscence of recent history, much of which he had witnessed at first hand. The putative author of these memoirs is the grandson of the prophet Zoroaster. Thanks to this privileged condition, he found himself everywhere that counted in what the scholar Karen Armstrong calls the Axial Age, a period of something less than 200 years that birthed most of the world's religions. Vidal's conceit is to shrink that era a bit and put them all within the range of the ambassador's very long life. So, from when the story begins, where he watches his young stonemason, Socrates building a wall that keeps falling down, he relates stories of meeting them all, from Mahavira to Confucius. But it was his interpretation of the Buddha that I find myself reminded of. The ambassador recounts how the Buddha would look right through him whenever they were talking. Apparently, well, according to Gore Vidal, the Holy One was in the habit of gazing into the middle distance rather than making eye contact with any person. Sometimes people think spirituality means cutting us off from life. Certainly we get that is the monk's mistake, or one of them. Clearly, with the story of the old woman and the monk, we see we're being invited in another direction. Or I hope we do. Eiken Roshi says he's only found two koans that touch on sexuality. This one and the other is collected in the Haradayasatani Miscellaneous Collection as the third question of Sun Yuan's Three Turning Words. Why is it that someone of great awakening does not cut off the vermilion thread? The Roshi's comment is the vermilion thread is the line of blood itself, the line of menstruation, sexuality, and birth. I would throw in of death as well. The whole thing. Messy. Sometimes unpleasant. Sometimes pleasant. Always compelling. One venerable commentator on the old tree on a cold cliff line, the monk said in response to the young woman, that if he had had that encounter, a green sprout would have appeared on that old tree. Messy, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes very pleasant, always compelling. And here I suggest we find the koan of this koan. What is your life? What do you feel? What is it that races through your heart and your mind? Where is your body in this story? That's the stuff of your work, my work, our work. That's where the koan is revealed. It isn't an invitation into licentiousness or prudery. There are appropriate and inappropriate actions in our lives. Think of it as a dance. And within the dance, we all must relate to each other as precious and as valuable as I hope we come to see we are. each of us as we are. As we are. We do this and truths reveal themselves. For one, all of us belong to that same great boundless family. One thing, empty and bright. And that other thing reveals too, you and me, just as we are, just as we are, fleshy and messy, angry, lustful, forgetful, shy, aggressive. Name it as yours. Know it. Really know it. It is the Buddha way presented. It is the Buddha way. Here with this racing heart, here with my own actions and their consequences, it is all revealed. No place else. In the monk, in the old woman, in the girl, in the burning of that hut, smoke rising, smell the ashes, and feel the sap rising, ready to send out a new branch. Look, feel, right here.
Please make yourselves comfortable. We're going to have our Dharma dialogue now, and I think everyone knows how that works.
Well, I have heard this koan before, James, and I always loved it. So thank you for talking about it today. And when you were talking about it today, something new came out of it for me, which was... the sense of permission to feel, you know, whatever, what is arising. So the monk there, you know, acting like the stone. And then the woman, you know, burning down the hut, you know, so mad, you know, just...
Yeah. That was an expensive 20 years.
Yeah. And so often it seems like we have this idea, you know, that... that we talked about constraints earlier today, wasn't that today? Who knows? Yeah,
that's what it was.
You know, and just that sense of freedom. So you know, it's there's the ethical obligations and not to harm, and you get the sense of that. You know, why is this woman sending this young girl off? To a trick, and then there's also the other side of it, which is. You know, this like you said, we're messy, we're alive, we're, you know, no hiding all that. It's all real. So that's what came to me. So thank you very much.
So I hesitate to start down this road, but this, as you were speaking, James, in some ways this koan speaks directly to my life as a college professor who is frequently in the company in my office of lovely young 18-year-old women who come to talk about their essay or about a poem that they're reading. So this is something I live through all the time and have since I myself was not so much older than they were, now that the winter snows have come. It's a little bit easier, right, than it was. Not so much to manage my reactions as theirs. But you know what I was thinking is that if a beautiful, young, sexually vibrant woman comes into my office and I pretend that that's not true, then I'm not fully present to her. If I pretend that I'm not affected, then I become kind of, you know, weird and awkward and, you know, professorial. And on the other hand, if I, you know, honor that too much, then I become a sleazy guy who, you know,
they start wearing plaid jackets.
Right. And I don't need to say anything. It's more that, you know, well, I was here to talk about my paper and my professor was sort of checking me out. So it's a very interesting situation to be in, and it's one that I never master. And it comes up day after day, and, you know, every time. I'm trying to balance, on the one hand, a real honesty about what I'm feeling and, you know, the energy in the room, and also, you know, a very strong sense to let this young woman know by the time she leaves my office that the very most important thing about her to me was her ideas and her reading of this poem, and that somebody that day, maybe, you know, the only time that day, really, you know, saw that in her more than anything else. And I don't know what else to say except that it's never gotten easy. And it does, though, get a little easier to manage as one gets older, because one is, you know, less of a...
It becomes more one-sided.
Right. Which is helpful.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, that's the I think you got it. You know, the prayer is not to be relieved of our feelings. It's to live them in a harmonious way, you know, in a way that respects everything that's going on. Ourselves, the other person, the other people, the situation, the task at hand. And
And you know, the dangerous piece in this, I love the way you put it, Alan, because you really got all the sensitivities and the subtleties of the relationship, and women that age, having been one myself, long to be talked to about their poetry, you know, and not looked over by an older man, even if they adore him in some way. So it just seems very, very respectful of not only her, but also of your own feelings. You know, you can respect your own feelings. But some of us studied with another teacher who used to use this koan as he only saw one side of it. And he said, you know, so clearly the monk was wrong. The woman was right to burn down the hut. What he should have done was seduced the young girl. And you can see that that's not so koan-like. But using koans as justification for all kinds of craziness, like, it would be like somebody saying, you know, really, if you really pay attention to koans, you should just go around cutting cats in two. And so I think I appreciate that, and it gave me an opportunity to say this, how it really is a koan. Because the mind won't get clear on what to do or what would I do if I was in that situation. But it disturbs us, which makes it a real koan. You know, it disturbs the trying to figure it out part of our brains. Thank you.
Well, I was just thinking that anytime there's an unequal relationship in terms of either spiritually or professionally, you have an ethical obligation for the person who's at a higher level not to take advantage of that. So it's true in a lot of professions, you know, not just in academics.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yes, you have to honor
position, you know.
Yes. Right. I mean, it goes both ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is why this is a tricky koan, because we correctly go to this exploration, especially in our recent times where we've seen examples of how these relationships are abused. And there's a koan in here, you know, and not to be lost as well.
So, thank you, James. The aspect that you just mentioned, I find endlessly disturbing about, you know, Zen teachers in particular, being, you know, a person of Zen, how it's so hard to understand how, you know, something like what Eva just said wouldn't be perfectly clear to someone who is in a position of power in in a religious community. How could they not, you know, it just seems impossible to me that you could justify that, you know, use Zen somehow to justify that. It just baffles me. I mean, I can understand the urges behind it, and I can even see it happening, you know, but to be able to somehow justify it, it seems impossible to me. And it's beyond what I can understand.
The human condition. Yeah, I mean, it is rough. It can.
Just hit pause there.
That's right. Yeah.
The human condition. It is rough.
Well, I was thinking of Eiken Roshi's comment about, I can't remember. He cites the Rinzai master who is exhorting young soldiers. You know, the sword and the strike is one, and it's all empty. And Aitken adds the comment, of course, there is that blood all over the floor, and the widow and the children. We can slip into the emptiness by itself. You know, there it is. It's people who see just the empty can justify anything, any action. And that's an incomplete, it's a real insight we have to have along the way, but we can't live there. You know, any more than seeing everything as equal, any of these where everything is equal. It is, and, you know, and there are consequences to every action.
Yeah. I think, Steve, where I go is the fact that it's so persistent and consistent throughout human history, not just to the Zen sect, but to all different religious, and in fact, almost any, where there's any power relationship. Even people of really good intention and great intelligence and insight fall into this. And so I think it, I guess where I go is that none of us can be protected from real blindness. And that our Zen practice will not protect us, our position will not protect us. And so partly the necessity of, for me, always remembering that, you know, we, those people who do that, are us, you know, and therefore how do we come together to support each other? I mean, I think part of our four guiding teachers is, you know, let's not just be one person there by herself, you know, being the one or himself, but quite a cautionary tale. I think we can very clearly look and judge and say, you know, this is absolutely wrong and harmful, but we can't separate ourselves from the one who does that.
Yeah. It brings to mind for me one of my other favorite koans, and I had forgotten how much of a favorite it was. The greatly enlightened person falls into a well. That's the whole koan. Right. And you know, I was thinking too, I was reading this wonderful murder mystery recently, and in it, one of the younger detectives gets very certain about the way things should be. He applies his clear ethical moral guidelines to a murder case and ends up doing something really, really stupid. And the older detective who's sort of schooling him basically says, the problem with you is you trusted your own mind. And I just read that and I thought, wait, who wrote this? it's just, and you know, and then goes on to this beautiful, I should try to find it, beautiful exposition of the way human beings actually work. That there's no clear pathway to truth ever, and there's, you know, all kinds of conditions that arise, and we do our best, and then we fall into the well, It's inevitable. And that's not to excuse it, because I think that is why we have ethical precepts. At least there's some guidance. And the other thing the detective says in this particular novel is, and that's why I follow the evidence. You know, anybody who knows murder mysteries knows that. It's like, I don't try to have an opinion. I try to go forward the best I can on the evidence of the senses, but also following these guidelines and not getting caught. And I love this koan, and I wish I could have talked about it myself, but I didn't dare, so it's really good that you did. Because it keeps flopping. You know, it'll fall into emptiness. You know, I should have just thrown her down on the pillow and screwed her, because there are no consequences to anything. I don't have sex with anybody who is, you know, some nubile young woman who comes to your hut. And it's that tension that I think it makes it an exciting koan for us. And interesting that it doesn't appear in any of our great collections, except as a folk tale or an addendum or a, you know. But I love that it's an Entangling Vines right there.
154.
Yeah, 154. Good number.
And it turns out K6 in the compendium of the Five Acts, which
cool.
I don't believe is, well, I don't know. It's not an anthology we use.
Mm-hmm. But stuff gets plucked from it.
Yeah. So, and the other one, and who knows how many are there as a source document. The other part, Alan's point, I think, you know, it dances into the koanic element. Mm-hmm. And the other sex koan, or the other koan that touches on sex, sexuality. Why is it that the awakened one does not separate from the vermilion thread? Yeah. Where else would we go?
The main reason I stopped going to the Naropa Institute, now Naropa University, was because it felt to me like no one could honestly talk about Trungpa's sexual indiscretions. And the whole thing was just so baffling to me. He had sex with a number of his students, and then, to me, even worse, his Dharma heir had sex with a bunch of people while neglecting to tell them he had AIDS. And it was, not really talked about. It would bubble up around the third semester or so. And the explanation was crazy wisdom. That in the mind of the enlightened one, you know, when you're in the emptiness realm, everything, we lowly Chris, who's got some fixed ethical standard about such a thing, for good reason, just couldn't understand. I just thought, oh, the guy took precepts, man. And, in my field, there's ethical guidelines so that when you feel your green sprout, you don't water it or fertilize it. Right? I mean, you can have a sprout and not be like...
What are we talking about
here? It's about gardening.
Okay. Got lost in a second. Yeah.
I love gardening. Zen gardening.
I think it's you don't transplant it. Or graft it, or whatever it may be. And, I so appreciate what you had to say, because, it's in my life as a minister, I experience similar moments and intimate conversation, an attractive person, to me that will always feel awkward. But I'm grateful to have, a really clear understanding of what the boundaries of that are. And, I don't know, it was just strange. And then when I would challenge folk to return to Naropa, a couple of them said, having sex with Trungpa was the most amazing day of my life. And I just thought, these people are crazy. And I didn't go back. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Hmm? Well, you know, what it makes me think about is how what Trungpa said about himself, from what I heard from one of his close disciples who didn't have sex with him for various reasons, who I remember talking to him, you know, it's like, how could he, how would it, and I remember this guy shrugged his shoulders and he said he was a sex addict and he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And he said that about himself, and he said to everybody, don't be like me. Which is pretty clear, you know. And I also think about all these people who live very, very tightly to ethical codes. They're almost the ones who become the most brittle and break in circumstances. And it, going back to what David said, the four guiding teachers, we talk to each other about these issues when they come up because it's so dangerous. And the when we get into that, I would never do that thing, that's when the trouble begins. And I've seen it in the Roman Catholic Church, and seen it among psychologists and my doctors, and of course among all kinds of religious teachers. So I think it's just not an easy one. But to face it, like to say, whoa, this, whatever James said earlier about being human, being difficult, this is a great example of that. Because it seems like, I'm just never going to do it. You know, I'll just stop. I'll stop drinking. I'll stop having sex with all my students. I'm quoting.
Those of you listening to the recording, she did not say that.
Yeah. Oh, and just dot, dot, dot. There's something really helpful about letting the mind, letting the sprout internally, mm-hmm. and then having somebody to share it with later who isn't the person that you want to seduce or isn't the substance you want to, you know, blitz out on. So it's really helpful to not be isolated and alone. I find it very helpful.
It just occurred to me that that part of this might be about whose practice is it? You know, if you're a student of Trungpa, is it his practice so that anything he does or says is, you just have to adhere to it? Or have you incorporated your own practice so that in some way or other, you know, you use the teachings, whether it's Zen or whatever, obviously for guidelines, but ultimately it's each person's own practice, and it's very dangerous. I think there's always the tendency to project so much on teachers, but it's just so dangerous and ultimately unfulfilling, you know, if our practice is not our own.
Mm-hmm. Great point.
That's a wonderful point. I think it's another reason, you know, Bamaswa Zen is the best Zen school on the planet, probably, that ever existed.
Probably.
Yeah. And will ever exist. And one of the reasons for that is that we do encourage people to see more than one teacher. You know, that we really do want just what you said to be, that the student is the final arbiter of guidance.
We would hope our practice is about being spiritual adults, not perpetually infanticized. Our system has this hierarchical relationship, and I think there are many gifts involved in it. But you're right; we have to, at some point, see for ourselves what our own practice. It's our practice. It's my practice. Your practice. And I'm also mindful of people who are students of the Zen teachers who are so heavily scandal-bound at this point. A lot of people will volunteer, you know, how helpful they were, what good teachers they have been and some of them the people who I would call victims. end at some point, you know. It's not like there's a written in the sky right and wrong, but there is useful and harmonious and harmful and not. And I think we in our time and place understand that about power. You know, that's the real, the obvious one. Even if it's not hard and fast, but it's hard and fast enough. You know, we should find the ways we can to live into it. Sangha, I think emphasizing Sangha much more is helpful on the way. Our own plan of diffusing the authority has been useful. And we have to be responsible, each of us. Yeah. And that takes us to the koan point, of course, which is just lovely how all this swirls around it and is not the point. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. And yet, in some ways, you know, you can't find the point without feeling all these mm-hmm. things.
Yeah. What is the point?
I think it was that thing that you're talking about with sprouts and fertilizer and transplants. Yes, that thing.
I felt also wasn't one point that how important it is to not cut ourselves off from our human emotions. I mean, with Zen practice, the goal is not to not be human, but to be more fully human in a way, more present in the moment, whatever arises. And that doesn't mean, you know, no passion.
So, that's right. That's right. That's right. No looking through people into the middle distance and being spiritual.
Right.
Yeah. It's real people being real people.
Let's sit for another moment or two.